We now begin Maseches Rosh Hashanah. This is the first Mishnah, first Perek, 1-1. And the Mishnah will discuss the various accounting New Years, if you will, regarding different halachic phenomena. The same way our year may begin on January the 1st, but some firms use a June 30th as a cutoff at the end of their fiscal year. And we have a school year that begins, you know, let's say it's September 1st, whatever the story is. So there are other years that begin at certain cutoff dates. And these cutoff dates are important for what I'll call accounting purposes. So the Mishnah says, Arba Roshei Shanim Hem. There are a total of four different dates in the calendar which serve as cutoffs to mark the beginning of a new year for various accounting purposes. The first is Be'echad Be'Nisan, the first day of the month of Nisan. We're starting with Nisan because that's the first month of the year. And the first day of the first month, first of Nisan, is Rosh Hashanah l'malachim v'l'regalim, is the first day of a new year for two accounting purposes. The first is for kings, and when we say kings, what we mean is in some kind of halachic contract or a get. So in the time that we had Jewish kings, we would use the date based on the year of the reign of the given Jewish king. We would say, you know, in the such a year of the such and such king's reign. Now, for accounting purposes, it would be nowadays probably easy to figure out the anniversary of the inauguration. And in America today, maybe you have like election day and you have the president comes in in January every 4 years. It's sort of easy to keep track, but that wasn't the case in antiquity. And therefore, they used a convention of the first day of Nisan being the cutoff, marking the second year of the king's reign. So, for example, if a king became inaugurated as king in the month of Adar, the month preceding Nisan. So come the 1st of Nisan, a few days later, that would mark the first day of the second year of his rule. And that would be the way that it would be expressed in an account of war in various shtaros contracts. Second of all, v'leregalim, and also for regalim. Regalim literally means the pilgrimage festivals. What this is referring to, however, I'm assuming else. This is referring to the law in the Torah, the prohibition called Baal Ta'acher, that one may not delay and push off his delivery of a neder or nedava, some sort of voluntary gift that he pledged to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. So a person, let's say, says, I commit to bring a sheep as a shlamim offering. It's a voluntary shlamim. That would be, of course, that's called a neder. So now the Torah says you may not delay in delivering your pledge. So when does one cross the line and violate this prohibition? So according to our Tana, it's going to be after three regalim, pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, pass in order, meaning that you have to pass through a Pesach and then a Shavuot and then a Sukkot, specifically in that order, to be over Baal Ta'acher, and then comes the end of Sukkot, you've crossed the line. So what that means is, let's say, for example, we're talking about the person who made the commitment to bring the Shlamim, let's say he does it during the Sfiras Omer period. In such a case, so what will happen is the first regal that will pass will be Shavuos, and then the second will be Sukkot, but that doesn't matter yet because we're saying, according to our mission here, the year begins, if you will, with the first of Nisan, meaning Pesach, and therefore we have to sort of have the three regalim in order. So you won't be crossing the line and violating Baal Ta'acher until another Pesach passes, and then another Shavuos, and another Sukkot. So the point is that it's three starting from Rosh Chodesh Nisan in that order, and that's because of the pasuk which says B'chaga Matos, V'chaga Shavuos, V'chaga Sukkos. There's a specific order for the holidays, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos, and therefore that's going to be the line in the sand, the first of Nisan, and you have to pass three after that in order to be over Baal Ta'acher. Two important points. The first is an FYI that there's actually a mitzvah ase to bring the pledged carbon as soon as possible, meaning if even the first of the regalim pass and you don't deliver it in that first regal, you've already violated the mitzvah ase. That's based on the pasuk that says, Uva'asa Shama, you'll come there to the place Hashem will choose. Let's call it Jerusalem. Ve'vesem Shama oloseichem v'zivchechem. You'll bring your olos and your other sacrifices, and if you fail to bring your voluntary sacrifice, you've already been mevatel the ase, you haven't done the commandment. properly. But the Baal Ta'acha, the lav, doesn't happen until, according to our Tana here, you pass the third regal in that order. The Bar Tanura learns, like the Rambam, that the halacha is not like this Tana, this is Rabbi Shimon, but the halacha actually follows the Tanaim who hold that it's any three in a row, any three regalim. So meaning the case I gave you before, if a person in the middle of Sfiras Omer period commits to bring a ned there, so then he'll only have Shavuos, Sukkos, and then Pesach, and when Pesach, that first Pesach, end of that Pesach, if he didn't bring it yet, he'll be over Baal Ta'achar. That's the halacha according to the Rambam. There are other Rishonim, like the Ritva and Rashba, who disagree, but I assume the halacha is like the Rambam. Okay, meaning the Ritva and the Rashba learn like our Mishnah, that indeed it has to be three in order, starting with Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Second of all, Be'echad Be'elul, on the first day of the month of Elul, that's Rosh Hashanah L'Maaser Behema, for the tithing of livestock. The cutoff is the first of Elul. The idea here is that one has to give a tenth, or I should say, if a person has, let's say he has cows, goats, or sheep, so if he has 10 cows, he's supposed to put them in a corral, and then they should come out of the corral one at a time. The tenth one out of the corral, daubed with red paint, and that becomes a korban called Maaser Behema. If a person only had 9 cows in a given year, so then he will not send any of his cows to be korbanos. None will be Maaser Behema. If a person had 19 cows, he only has 1 cow. That'll be Maaser Behema. That'll be the 10th one that comes out when he puts all 19 inside the corral. If he has 20 cows, he'll bring 2 as Maaser Behema. Okay, so there's a rule, and the rule is that you can't tithe last year's cows on this year's cows, or vice versa. That rule is basically learned out from a very similar rule that applies to agricultural produce, which must be tithed. Now, the Pasuk in Devarim Perek Yudalet, Pasuk Chav Beis, 14:22 says, Aser ta aser es kol tfuas zera'echa hayotzi hasadeh. You'll certainly tithe all of your grain that comes from your fields, shana shana, year by year. And shana shana, year by year, tells you that you only can tithe this year's grain on this year's grain. You can't, you know, combine this year and last year's grain and then tithe some from this year on last year and vice versa. Therefore, that means you have to have some cutoff date, which says, defines which year a given, you know, given grain belongs to. And we learn similarly, that's going to apply to animals as well. So the cutoff will be, according to the Tana here, the first day of the month of Elul. And the reason why Elul is chosen is because by the time Elul rolls around, Elul is the end of the summer. And by then, all the animals have really, all livestock have normally been, have given birth. Hashem arranged it that animals are born, livestock are typically born in the spring and summer so they can have a chance to grow in warm weather and when there's food around before the winter comes. And therefore, by Rosh Chodesh El, all the animals are normally born. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shimon, Omrim Be'echad B'Tishrei, they actually disagree and they say, no, the first of El is not the cutoff date for the measuring which year an animal belongs to. Rather, it's the first day of Tishrei, the same as other grain, etc. And the reason why is because they also understand that we're connecting the obligations of Maaser Behema, tithing the animals year by year, to the Maaser of the Tefuah, of the grain. And just as when it comes to grain, the cutoff is the first day of Tishrei, so too, when it comes to animals, the cutoff should be the first day of Tishrei. That's their Shita. The Tanakama, the previous Shita, held that just as when you finish processing your grain and you're going to give your tithes, that'll be at the end of the summer, meaning at the end of Elul, because Tishrei already starts to rain. You have the holidays and then rain, so you finish by then. So too, when the animals are finished having their babies, which will be already done by the first of Elul, you can give your Maaser Behema. Okay. The Mishnah goes on to say, Be'echad B'Tishrei, the first day of Tishrei, what we call Rosh Hashanah conventionally, so that actually is the Rosh Hashanah l'shanim v'l'shmitin v'l'yovlos v'l'natia v'l'yirakos for 5 different phenomena. The first is shanim, years. This is a reference very similar to the talking about the malachim we had before, but the years, as you count them, when you want to count the Gentile overlord, let's say the emperor, we also, for the purposes of promoting peace, would recognize in our contracts back then who the Gentile overlord was, so we would say, you know, in such and such a year of the Persian, you know, emperor so-and-so's reign, And that was just essentially to make sure that there's, you know, we acknowledge them and make sure we have peaceful relations with them. So that will be done. The second year of, in our accounting purposes, the second year of such and such a king's reign would begin at the first of Tishrei. Now, that practice is long gone. There was an interim practice called Minyan Shtaros, where they would count the years based on Alexander the Great, Alexander HaMakdon, the Macedonian, as they call it in Hebrew, the Chazal, which basically works out to 310 BC, the year 3449, the Jewish calendar as we count it today, 380 years prior to the Churban. But that's also lapsed. Nowadays, we don't do any of that. There's no point in counting Goyish kings at all because the Goyim themselves don't do that. So why should we try to promote peace if they don't care? We don't care. But we do count instead from the creation of the world. So we would have the year 5781 or whatever the case may be to keep track of the years. And that's how we do it nowadays. Okay. Next you have Lishmitin. Shmitin is referring to the Shemitah year. Every 7 years of the agricultural cycle is a Shemitah year. During that year, it's forbidden to plow and plant, and the produce has a certain kedusha to it. The rules of Shemitah kick in, and that's going to happen midoraisa from the first day of Tishrei. That's when the Shemitah year begins. Vili Yovlos. Yovlos, the Jubilee years. So the way that the Bar Tanura, the Rambam learn it is, after seven cycles of 7 years, after that seventh Shemitah year, the fifth, that's 49 years, of course. The 50th year will be the Yovel year. So you'll have Yovel year the day after the year after the Shemitah year. And the Yovel year basically is another Shemitah year. So you'll have 2 years of Shemitah where the land lies fallow, the produce has sanctity, no trumas and maestras, everyone has access to the fruits, etc. That's the Yovel year. Yovel, in addition, has two other major features. One is that if you had an indentured servant, a Jewish, an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave, who they're going to go free. Even an Eved Ivri who said, I don't want to go free, I want to live with my master and the household, I like my life over here. Even him, the Nirtza, the guy who has the ear punctured on the doorpost guy, so even he goes free in the Yovel year, regardless of whether he wants to or not. And similarly, there's a rule that ancestral lands, I'm not talking about Arei Batechoma, if you're familiar, in walled cities, houses in walled cities, forget that, not my topic right now. But ancestral plots of land, they belong to a person, to a Sheva, to a tribe, and if one would sell his ancestral plot, comes the Yovel year, it reverts back to its original owners. So that's what's happening in the Yovel. The Yovel begins on the first day of Tishrei. Worth noting, actually, is that in practice, the first of Tishrei, actually nothing different is going to happen because the previous day, the last day of Elul, was already Shemitah, so the Shemitah just continues on the next day, the first of Tishrei. And as well, the releasing of the slaves and the return of the ancestral plots won't actually happen until the blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur, the 10th day of Tishrei, then actually when things will go into effect. But the Shemitah, the Yovel year begins the first of Tishrei. V'l'natiyah. A natiya is a sapling, and this is the Rosh Chodesh for saplings. In Hebrew, there are three words for trees. You have eitz, ilan, and natiya. They don't mean the same thing exactly. An eitz is a tree, period. A natiya is an immature tree, like a sapling, and an ilan is a mature tree. So when we say natiya here, we mean like baby trees, and we need to keep track of the baby trees' age, because the first 3 years of a fruit tree's life, its fruit is called orla. It's proscribed, it's blocked off, forbidden. And we need to keep track of how old the tree is. So we don't measure a tree from the year the day it was planted. Rather, we measure it. Its second year, if you will begin when it crosses over the birthday for all saplings, which is the first day of Tishrei. Now, just to be a little more precise here, the accounting works that for a tree to be considered to be in its second year come the first of Tishrei, it has to have taken root and been enrooted in the ground for at least 30 days prior to the first day of Tishrei. And we also paskin that it takes 14 days for a sapling to take root. So that gives you 30 plus 14 is 44. So if you want to plant your tree in such a way that when we get to Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, it'll enter its second year, What you'll have to do is plant your tree no later than 45 days before the first of Tishrei, which is going to work out to Tu B'Av, the 15th day of the month of Av. Now, that's how it works. And if you planted it by Tu B'Av, so then comes the first of Tishrei, your tree has entered into its second year for the count of Orla. Now, just this isn't even as simple as it already didn't sound. More than that, comes the second first of Tishrei. So now we're talking, let's say, if you planted on Tu B'Av, we're talking about 13 and a half months after you planted your tree. Now your tree will enter its third year. It remains, the produce remains Orla. At the end of that year, when the first of Tishrei rolls around, so you have planted your tree 2 years, which is 24 months plus a month and a half, so you're 25 and a half months ago on Tu B'Av you planted this tree. Now it's entering into its, would be fourth year. The problem is, once it is entering to that fourth year, it's already now become no longer a netia, a sapling. It's now been promoted to being an ilan. And the Chag Ilanot, as we'll see in the Mishnah shortly, the Rosh Chodesh for an ilan, a mature tree, is, we pass in Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat's a few months later. So what will happen is, even though it's passed now into its, what you would have thought was his fourth year, comes the first of Tishrei, no, since this no longer is a netia, but now an ilan, it's still, its produce is still Orla until it passes through the month of Tishrei, the month of Cheshvan, the month of Kislev, the month of Teves, and half of the month of Shvat, so 4.5 months. So we said the minimum would be 25 and a half months till it gets to that beginning of its fourth year, would be fourth year with Rosh, the first day of Tishrei. That's 25 and a half months, but then you have 4.5 more months until you get to the 15th of Shvat. So that means that your tree will stop being an Orla tree or having Orla produce at a minimum of 30 months after you plant it, okay? And it could be much more than 30 months, even up to 42 months if you planted it, 40 months roughly, if you planted it earlier in the year, okay? So earlier in the year instead of Tu B'Av. Anyways, that's what we're talking about here. And by the way, and then once the, that's for Natia. And yurakos are vegetables. So the rule is that a vegetable also has to be subject to various tithes. It's subject to Shemitah. To determine the vintage of a given vegetable, it's determined by when you pick the vegetable. So if you pick a cucumber, the year to which it belongs is the year when you picked it. And now, since you can't tie this year's produce on last year's produce, and similarly, you might need to give in years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the cycle, you give Maaser Sheni. In years 3 and 6, you give Maaser Ani. You have to determine which year this cucumber belongs to, and that will be based on when you picked it. And if you picked it before Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, then it's the previous year's. If you picked it after the first of Tishrei, it's this year's. Okay, that's that. Now, Be'echad B'Shvat, on the first of Shvat, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan, by the way, you notice we didn't mention anything about Rosh Hashanah being a day of judgment. That's not the point of our Mishnah. Our Mishnah is discussing accounting. Next Mishnah, we'll talk about judgment. So, the fourth and final of the Rosh Hashanah is Be'echad B'Shvat, on the first day of the month of Shvat. That's Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan. That's the Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the new year for Ilanot, mature trees, Kedivri Beis Shammai, that was Beis Shammai Shita, but Beis Hillel say no, Beis Hillel Omrim, B'chamisha Sarbo, not till the 15th of Shvat, Tu B'Shvat, do the trees have their new year. Of course, you pass like Beis Hillel. The Machlokas here, Beis Shammai say that once you get to the first of Shvat, already most of the rain for the year has fallen, and therefore the sap's beginning to grow. This is sort of like the beginning of the new year, and soon we'll see the trees begin to blossom. You know, Shkedia Parachat, the almond tree blossoms first, typically, and so on. So Beis Shammai says that's we're like on the second half of the rainy season, and therefore that'll be the cutoff. Beis Hillel say no, we want to be the second half of the winter season, just like we're accustomed to. Winter's 3 months long, and far in the secular accounting, 21st of December approximately marks the beginning of winter. 21st of March, approximately March, the end of winter and the beginning of spring. So too, the winter is called the Tekufas Teves, the beginning of Teves marks the beginning of winter. So those 3 months, Tevet, Shvat, and Adar, those are the three winter months. And Beis Hillel say, so the middle of the middle month, middle of Shvat, is the 15th of Shvat. So that will be, once you get to 15th of Shvat, you've passed the first half of the winter and the second half of winter, and now, again, the sap's beginning to flow in the trees. Things are, you know, we're moving towards a new year. And at Tu B'Shvat already, we'll begin the new year for the Ilanot, and that, of course, is the Halacha. So the Machlokas describing here is Beis Shammai say the second half of the rainy season, versus Basil says the second half, you reach the second half of the winter season. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Beis, 1-2. Now our Mishnah will discuss when Hashem judges the world, and it will say, Ba'arba Prakim, there are actually four different junctures, Ha'olam Nidon, on which the world is judged. So we'll see here. Let me read you the whole Mishnah first to see it all. B'Pesach al HaTavua, on the holiday of Pesach, there's a judgment regarding the grain. B'Atzeret al Peros HaElan, on the holiday of Shavuos, referred to as Atzeres, the Mishnah, there's a judgment regarding the fruit of the trees. B'Rosh Hashanah, on our Rosh Hashanah, Kol Baya Olam, over in the fun of Kimnei Maron, everyone passes before Hashem. Shneimar, as the pasuk says, Hayota Yacha Libam Hamavin Eskol Maasehem. Hashem knows what's going on with everybody. He sees everyone with the blink of an eye, and the judgment is on everybody. And then Uvachag, and on the holiday of Sukkot, referred to as Chag, Nidon Nalamayim, there's a judgment on water. Okay, let me take this apart piece by piece. But first of all, you see there are basically two different categories, right? There's the judgment on all of humanity, and then there's the judgments on each of the three pilgrimage festivals regarding a specific aspect of blessing. So let's just take those apart in turn and discuss how they could work together. When it comes to Pesach al HaTavua, the judgment on Pesach is for the grain. This makes sense in as much as this is the beginning of the ripening of the grain, and that's when the blessing and the judgment happens. A brisa brings down in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that Hashem asks us to bring a korban, an offering, the korban omer, that barley offering that's brought from the barley, which is the first of the ripening grains, so that we may bring this offering, and he may bless us, because that's when he's judging us. And it's the textual basis to a source that shows that the judgment happens on Pesach for grain, is that that's when Hashem wants to give us a blessing regarding his judgment. Same goes for Ba'atzeres al Peres Ha'ilan, on Shavuos, the judgment regarding the fruit of the trees. Again, Hashem requests we bring the Shtei HaLechem, these two loaves of bread that are made from wheat, and when we bring that offering and wave it before Hashem, we get the blessing regarding our fruit. And finally, I'm skipping over the mission, going out of order now, when it comes to B'chag, and on Sukkot, Nidon Alamayim, the judgment on water, that's the beginning of the rainy season. And we bring this, we're commanded to bring this water libation, like the Simchas Pesach Shavuot, you call it, the water libation done throughout Sukkot. And by doing so, Hashem will bless us regarding water. So it makes sense, the beginning of the grain is Pesach, the beginning of ripening is Pesach, the beginning of the fruits ripening is Shavuot, the beginning of the rainy season is Sukkot, and therefore it's an appropriate time to get judged, and therefore Hashem gives us a mechanism to earn a blessing and a good judgment. There is a bit of a question, perhaps, in as much as the Shavuos part, how we see that the connection between ripening grain and bringing the Omer, water and bringing the water libation, how exactly is bringing the Shtei HaLechem, the wheat loaves of bread, exactly appropriate for getting a judgment regarding fruit on the trees? So the way the Brisa presents it, it just says matter of fact, and the rationale would be that according to that Tana, the fruit that Adam Arishon, Adam, ate back in the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, was wheat. Wheat used to grow on trees proper, and he holds it was wheat, and therefore it's appropriate. The fruit on the tree is wheat, that's an appropriate thing to bring. Period. That's the sources. I've heard it said many times, this idea that, echoing this idea, that what we bring on Shavuos are the first fruits, Bikurim, and that, of course, would give us a blessing regarding our first fruits. That makes a lot of sense. It sounds very nice. It happens to not be what the Brisa says, but that's that. Okay, now those are the three specific judgments regarding produce and rain. Now, the other part is that it says, Uvarosh Hashanah, on the Rosh Hashanah, meaning on the first of Tishrei, what we call Rosh Hashanah, Kol Boi Olam, everybody on planet Earth, every person, every human being, Ovren Lefanav, pass before God, Kivnei Maron. According to the Bartanura, this means like little sheep. Maron is a cognate of the word Imrana. Imrana means sheep in Aramaic. And it means like little sheep, the same way that a shepherd counts every sheep. They go in and go out. They come in and out through a little, like, you know, a little opening inside the corral, one at a time. He keeps an eye on each one of them. So to Hashem, every single person passed for Hashem one at a time. He's the great shepherd, so to speak, who looks after his flock, each and every individual. And that's the reference here. The Gemara brings two other pshatim. One is that Maron is like from a lashon of Marus, which means like the authorities, referring to soldiers who are subject to the authority of the king. In the same way soldiers march carefully, they are each scrutinized one at a time, they're held to a high standard. So to all of humanity, in the same way, servants of Hashem, so to speak, are judged individually to march to do Hashem's bidding and so on. The third pshat is, it's a reference to like the city of Meron, and it's Kamalos Base Maron, like the ascent up to the place called Meron, like made famous nowadays because of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's tomb being there. I should point out that Shammai's tomb is also there, etc. But in any case, so the ascent up to Meron was like a narrow, treacherous ascent with a narrow path on which people to walk single file as they fall off the edge. The idea is similar being that people are walking up the mountain, and they're being judged one at a time, passing single file, each getting scrutinized by Hashem. At all events, the point is that Hashem judges everybody individually. Shene'emar, as the Pasuk says, Hayotzer Yachad Libam, the one who forms their hearts together, Hamevin El Kol Ma'aseim, he understands all their acts. Hashem knows the motivations and depth of every person's actions. The fact that it's referring to me as being the Yotzer, the one who formed them, indicates certainly that the time that's appropriate for judging them is the day in which they were formed, humanity was formed, which is the first day of Tishrei, when Adam Rishon was formed. Okay, so that's the judgment of Rosh Hashanah, as we know it, that everyone's judged. There is a bit of a question, how to reconcile these two things. If everyone's getting judged in Rosh Hashanah, what's the relevance of the judgments that are happening on Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot? So, the resolution of this question kind of revolves typically around sort of like Hashgacha Pratis and Kalalis, a general or a specific judgment. That is to say that, you know, Hashem judges you as an individual on Rosh Hashanah, but the world is all how much rain will fall, total quantity of rain, or how much fruit will grow, etc., or the quality of the fruit. That's done on the respective other days of judgment, and he puts those two things together. And what's really important to understand here, I want to make sure, Hashgachic point before we move on, is that the Torah and Judaism does not believe in predestination. Even if Hashem judges you for such and such in Rosh Hashanah, that just means that if everything goes according to the normal course of events. But you're always able to change your decree either by your bechira, by your free choice, by doing tshuva. Certainly you have until Yom Kippur, for starters, everyone knows that, to change things around for a Beinoni. That's the reason why you hear there's still, you know, what happens till Hoshana Rabbah and so on and so forth. When the Torah says something is going to happen, it only means unless people do something extraordinary to change the course of events. But you can. That's certainly true. Similarly, if it says, the Torah says, you know, 40 days before the Yetzirah Savlad, the child is, you know, formed in utero, the voice comes out in heaven and says, you know, this is the Shidduch, so-and-so will marry so-and-so. Even though that's true that it happens, that just means under the normal circumstances of course events. But you can do something abnormal to change the course of your life so that you won't marry your shidduch, etc., etc. The point is, my point here is that it's not a fatalistic religion, or there's not such thing as predetermination or even as fate. No, Hashem guides each person's life with precision in Hashgacha Pratis, and a person can certainly change whatever is decreed at any time based on his doing tshuva and earning it and so on. And that's very, very important to know. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Gimel, 1-3. The Mishnah turns its attention to the sanctification of the new moon, and that becomes the focal point for the next two prakim. This Mishnah actually focuses on the last step of the process, which would be after the new moon and month has been sanctified. So then the Beis Din would send out emissaries, that's the Sanhedrin Agadol, the Sanhedrin would send out emissaries to the Jewish communities outside of Jerusalem to notify them of which day had been consecrated as the new moon and the beginning of the new month, so they could observe the holidays properly. And therefore the Mishnah says, Al Shisha Chadashim Hashluchin Yotzin. There were 6 months in the year on which the emissaries from the Sanhedrin would go out to notify the Jewish communities around their Yisrael and beyond. Al Nisan v'pnei ha-Pesach. The first of the six was the month of Nisan. Again, we're starting from Nisan every time. Nisan, they needed to know when the month of Nisan began so they could observe the holiday of Pesach properly. Al Av. We now skip all the way to the month of Av, v'pnei ha-Tainus. Because of the Tainus, that's the requirement to fast on the 9th, Tisha B'Av, in recognition of the two Batei Mikdash that were destroyed. It becomes a national day of mourning. You'll note that the Mishnah skipped Tammuz already, as well as Sivan before that. The reason why it skipped Sivan is because, although it's true that Shavuos does happen to fall out in Sivan, one doesn't need to know when Rosh Chodesh Sivan is to observe Shavuos properly. Shavuos is defined as exactly the 50th day from the count after with the Omer starting in Pesach time. So that's that. As far as Tammuz goes, there's of course a fast on the 17th of Tammuz, which was also a terrible day for the Jewish people, as set forth in Maseches Tainus. However, technically, the requirement to fast on Tammuz, as well as on Gimel Shvat, etc., and Asar B'Tevis, are rabbinic, and the din is technically that if it's in a time when there is no gezeros, no decrees against the Jewish community, and the Jews aren't under the thumb of Gentile oppressors, so then it's up to the community to decide whether they want to fast or not. And in theory, a community could decide that not to observe the fast day of, let's say, the 17th of Tammuz, in which case they would not be required to do so. And since there's no strict obligation, therefore, in the same way as there is on Tisha B'Av, which was the most severe of the days, and recognizes requirements, of course, already in the Pesukim, etc. So on those days, there's no necessary requirement to send out shluchim. They can rely on their calculations and their local customs. But when it comes to Tisha B'Av, not the case. Now, when it comes to, let's say, Pesach, we had before, the observance is based on what the emissaries notify the community. For communities that are further far afield, that the emissaries can't reach them in time to notify them when Pesach would fall out, when they have to go to the Chometz, etc. So those communities would be observing 2 days of Pesach based on the Suffolk. Since it's uncertain, they'll observe both days, Misuffolk, the Sidoraisa, Pesach, and that's the source of the famous Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galios, the 2 days of Yom Tov out in the exile. As far as the calculations go, it's important to know that the emissaries would not be Mechal Shabbos, and they would not be Mechal Yom Tov. They wouldn't travel on those days to get further far out to notify Jewish communities. And therefore, actually, not in Nisan, Pesach time, but in Tishrei would be the smallest window of opportunity to travel, because they wouldn't leave on the first 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. That's already 1 day of Yom Tov. Of course, they're going to pass through a Shabbos, and then you also have Yom Kippur. Typical years, it wouldn't be the same necessarily, so they won't travel on Yom Kippur either. So that means that the time which they would have to get to the communities to notify them when Sukkot would fall out was shorter, a smaller window than the time to get to notify them about when Pesach would fall. The minhag is that communities that didn't know all the holidays, including Sukkot, when they arrived with certainty, those are the ones who kept 2 days of Yom Tov and out of Suffolk, and the ones that always knew in time, they're the ones that kept 1 day of Yom Tov. The Mishnah continues on now and says, we're listing 6 months. We've had 2 so far. The third is Al Elul Mipnei Rosh Hashanah. They went out in the month of Elul, which of course is the month that precedes Rosh Hashanah, to notify the communities when Rosh Chodesh Elul was, so they can know when to observe Rosh Hashanah. This is because in the vast majority, and essentially as to the extent that Chazal could arrange it, every Elul was a short month of just 29 days, so the 30th day from Rosh Chodesh Elul would be Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, what we call Rosh Hashanah. And therefore they relied on that rove, the majority of instances. According to Rashi, in the time of the Mishnah, they only kept 1 day Rosh Hashanah. Tosfos says no. In any case, now of course you have 2 days, but in any case they needed to know when Rosh Hashanah would fall to the best of their ability, because of course there's no way for the emissaries to get from Yerushalayim very far on Rosh Hashanah to notify them when Rosh Hashanah was confirmed to be. So they relied on that rove. Al Tishrei, now in the month of Tishrei, they would go out again, Mipnei Takanas Hamoados, to fix up the holidays. This is because, of course, there wasn't just one but 2 holidays in Tishrei, both Yom Kippur as well as Sukkot. And although they did rely on the majority of Elul's being 29 days to figure out when Rosh Hashanah was, people were nervous when it comes to Yom Kippur to rely on just that assumption. Although it's true, Midrash, you can rely on the row of the majority of cases, but still, it's Yom Kippur. No one wants to find out after the fact that they took a leniency and ended up eating on Yom Kippur, and therefore, to the extent possible, we notify the communities when Yom Kippur will fall so that they could not fast on the wrong day, and then they continue to go on so they can know when Sukkot is as well. Al Kislev b'pnei Chanukah. Kislev, of course, the end of the month, 25th, becomes Chanukah, and therefore they need to know when to observe it, so that, again, the emissaries went out. It seems from many sources that farther out communities kept an extra day, let's call it 9 days, of Chanukah because of this suffix. Not all agree to that, but it seems very, very, very possible, even though it's a derabbanan. Al Adar b'pnei Purim. They also went out, the 6th month was an Adar. They went out to notify people when the Rosh Chodesh Adar was, so they could observe Purim properly on the 14th or 15th, if it was a walled city, from the time of Joshua. So that, of course, is a requirement as well. It seems that they did not keep 2 days of Purim, even if they did keep 2 days of Hanukkah or an extra day of Hanukkah. And perhaps the reason why is because there's a special verse in the Megillah which says, Lo Ya'avor, you can't cross over past the 15th to an extra day. That being the case, perhaps is the reason why they only kept 1 day of Purim wherever they were as appropriate, regardless of their Hanukkah observance. Ukshaya Beis HaMikdash Kayim. When there was the Beis HaMikdash standing, Yotzin Af Al Iyar Mipnei Pesach Katan, also for the holiday of Pesach Sheni, which happens in the month of Iyar, the month after Nisan, those who are too far to bring their Korban Pesach and would bring their Pesach Sheni the next month, and they need to know the timing of that to know what kind of rush they were in and when they had to get to Yerushalayim by, and therefore, again, the emissaries went out to notify people about Pesach Sheni to bring their Korban Pesach, but that, of course, only applicable when there is a Beis HaMikdash to bring the Korban Pesach, Pesach Sheni, and therefore it only was applicable during the time when the Beis HaMikdash was standing. Rosh Hashanah Perek Aleph, Mishnah Dalet 1-4. The Mishnah turns to a new topic, and it doesn't give you very prominent signposting that we've gone on to a new topic, and therefore you are likely to misunderstand this Mishnah and what it's talking about. The Mishnah is talking about the witnesses, the Edim, who will come to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Sanhedrin, to testify they saw the new moon. The Mishnah, since it continues after the last Mishnah, which was talking about the emissaries, the Shluchim, going from the Sanhedrin, one would think this is talking about those same people, but it is not. It's changed topic, and that really becomes the focal point of much of the next Mishnayos here, for the next, whatever, 17 Mishnayos or something. We're going to talk about the Edim and how they came to Yerushalayim and testified. So, Al Shnei Chadashim Mechalin Es HaShabbos. On 2 months, they would, even if it was necessary, be Mechal Shabbos, desecrate the Shabbos, meaning they would travel beyond the Tchum, etc., on Shabbos, to give their testimony. We are not talking about the Shluchan of the previous Mishnah, who I told you would never be Mechal Shabbos or Yom Tov, but the Edim who are going to come to testify that they saw the new moon on the previous night will come. It has to be done today. The Pasuk says, Ela Modei Hashem Mikre Kodesh Asher Tikru Osam B'mo Adam. You will declare them B'mo Adam in their proper time, and therefore, even on Shabbos, you got to come and testify. So, really, Midoraisa, that could happen all 12 months of the year, but the rabbi said without a Beis HaMikdash, it's only relevant for 2 of the 12 months, which would set up the calendar, and therefore, although Midoraisa all 12 months, Midorabanan, only on 2 months do they allow them to be Mechal Shabbos. Al Nisan Val Tishrei, and those are for the months of Nisan and Tishrei, because from Nisan and Tishrei, you will be able to establish, if you know Rosh Chodesh Nisan and Rosh Chodesh Tishrei correctly, from there, the rest of the Jewish calendar, meaning the 3 Regalim, as well as Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which are the 5 Doraisa holidays, can all be established since they fall out in Nisan or Tishrei, or in the case of Shavuos, exactly as a function of when Pesach falls out. Shebehen Hashluchin Yotzin L'Suria. On those months, in addition, because the calendar is really focused on that, they need to go all the way to Suria, all the way out to Suria, which is like modern-day Syria, and actually, on the other months, because remember the previous missions that they go out on 6 months of the year, on the other months, they also went out, of course, not just on these 2 months, but on those months, they would go out really from the, to get a little extra time, they go out earlier. If they saw that it was clearly evident when the new moon was, if it was Ba'alil, if it was in, like, you know, bright and clear for everybody, they wouldn't necessarily wait. But for these 2 months of Nisan and Tishrei, they would wait until they heard the Bezin explicitly say Mekudash, that the holiday has been, the month has been sanctified. And that being the case, they had less time to travel, it's more of a rush, and of course, these are the most important months to set up the calendar for the Doraisa holidays, so therefore, for all the reasons, we make sure that the Edom are there on time and know, even if it means them being Machal Shabbos. Uvehen misaknin es ha-moados, from those holiday, the Rosh Chodesh, as they're established, that's when all the holidays, the moados, the different Doraisa festivals, etc., will be established. Ukashaya Beis HaMikdash Kayam, when there was a Beis HaMikdash standing, so then Mechalin Afal Kulan, then all 12 months of the year, the witnesses were allowed to be Mechal Shabbos and bring their testimony, Bipnei Takanas HaKorban, because you needed to get the special Korban Musaf, the additional offering that was brought on Rosh Chodesh, of course, needs to be brought in its proper time, and can only be brought if they knew when Rosh Chodesh was. That's a Doraisa obligation, therefore, we let all of the Edom who saw the new moon come, even on Shabbos, every month of the year, when there's a possibility to bring the Musafim, the extra offerings that are brought on Rosh Chodesh. But when there's no Beis HaMikdash, no need to do that, and therefore it's only done on these 2 months of Nisan and Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Hei, 1-5. In the previous Mishnah, we had established that there is a mitzvah, an obligation, mid-oraisa, from the Torah, to ensure that Edom come to testify. As the Pasuk says, Ela Moadei Hashem, Mikre Kodesh, Asher Tukrosam B'Moadam. They have to be decreed B'Moadam in their proper time. And therefore, the Mishnah said that the Edom can be Mechal Shabbos, in truth, every month, but Medurabanan, when the Beis Midrash doesn't stand, and there's no need to bring the Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, the only Mechal Shabbos on Nisan and Tishrei. The Mishnah here says, what happens if the moon is high in the sky, it's bright and visible, even then do we allow people to be Mechal Shabbos? Because presumably back in Yerushalayim, the Bezdin and the locals can see for themselves and could use local witnesses without needing people to come from afar, traveling from beyond the Tchum to Mechal Shabbos to bring their testimony, etc. And therefore the Mishnah says, Bein Shenira Va'alil, Bein Shalanira Ba'alil. Whether the new moon could be seen prominently, high above the horizon, clear, or whether it could not be seen clearly, meaning it was either there was cloud coverage, it was close to the sun, therefore it was occluded because of the brightness of the sun, it was low in the horizon, therefore hard to see. In all those cases, doesn't matter. Mechal Nalav Es HaShabbos. The obligation to bring witnesses requires they come, and therefore the witnesses should still come, even though they are very possibly not going to need to be giving their testimony because it was visible and there are probably many witnesses back in Yerushalayim. Nevertheless, they are encouraged to come, they're permitted to come, on, even if it means being Mechal Shabbos. Rabbi Yossi Omer Imnira Va'alil. Rabbi Yossi disagrees. He says, listen, if the new moon could be seen prominently in the sky, Ein Mechal Nalav Es HaShabbos, then they should not be Mechal Shabbos to come from a distance to testify. Rabbi Yossi agrees that really Mikra Adin, according to the Torah law, they could come. He doesn't dispute the drasha. He just says, the rabbi said, better not to come. Why should people be Mechal Shabbos for no good reason, when really, presumably, there's plenty of witnesses back in Yerushalayim who could do it, and no need for people to be Mechal Shabbos. However, the halacha follows the Tanakhama, as we'll see more in the next Mishnah, meaning that any witness who sees the new moon should come, even if he is likely to have lots of company when he gets there, with other witnesses bearing the similar testimony. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Vav, 1-6, a straight continuation of the previous Mishnah, and in fact, a story when it actually happened. Maasa, it once happened, She'avru Yoser Me'arbaim Zug, more than 40 pairs of witnesses coming to testify regarding the new moon, passed by Ve'ikvan Rabbi Akiva V'Lud. And Rabbi Akiva, who was living in the town of Lud, the ancient city of Lida, near the modern-day Ben-Gurion Airport, city of Lud, in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Akiva saw all these witnesses coming, and he stopped them. He held them back. He says, don't go any further, stay here in Lud, because obviously if there are 40 pairs of you passing through, there are plenty of people to testify and no need to be Mechal Shabbos. However, admitting that Rabbi Akiva held, like Rabbi Yossi, that no need to go if it's seen prominently. However, Shalach lo Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel, who was the Nazi, sent a missive to Rabbi Akiva saying, Im akivata es arabim, if you hold the masses back from coming to testify when they have testimony, nimtzeisa machshilin la'asid lavo, it'll turn out that you're messing things up for the future. Because in the future, people say, listen, if I'm going to head out to Lud and get stopped halfway and be stuck there, so I'm not going to do that again. I'm just not going to go next time. And then people won't come, and the Bezin might actually need witnesses, and there won't be any to come because no one wants to bother lest they get messed up and stranded or held back or held up. And therefore, the halacha follows Rabban Gamliel, that people who have testimony should come, and everyone has to do their part, and even if it means that they're not needed, so that's fine. And we'll see more about how we made them feel important as the Mishnahs continue. Just one thing before I wrap it up here. If you're asking yourself, wait a second, Lud is somewhere near Ben Gurion Airport in modern-day Eretz Yisrael. That's a very long walk from Yerushalayim. There's no chance that a person could make that walk on Shabbos, and that, you know, what's going on over here? Why would they all converge in Lud if they're headed to Yerushalayim? The answer is that this Mishnah occurred when Rabban Gamliel was a Nasi, after the Chorban of Bayis Sheni, and the Sanhedrin had relocated from Yerushalayim to the city of Yavne. Yavne is just a couple hours walk from the town of Lud, and therefore what's happening is the people were walking to Yavne and passing through Lud and not to Yerushalayim. Rosh Hashanah, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Zion 1:7. Now we talk about the witnesses and the criteria for who can give testimony for seeing the new moon. The Mishnah says, Av uvano shero es hachodesh yelechu. If a father and son both see the new moon, they should go to testify. Lo shemitztarfen zemze, not because they could testify together. Elish im yipasel echad mem, but if one of them would become invalidated, yitztarf hasheni im acher, the other family member could still team up with another witness to give satisfactory testimony to allow for the new moon to cause the month to be Mukudash, to be decreed. Now, what's going on over here is that there's a requirement when it comes to testimony to in Jewish courts, al pi shnei edim, you need two edim to be yakum davar, to establish the halachic fact. And that's true for not just for capital cases and monetary cases, but also even for the kiddush, the sanctification of the new month, because it's also referred to, kiddush hachodesh is also referred to as mishpat, it's hard to translate exactly, the law, and so too, whenever any mishpat, any juris, you know, any consideration regarding the law requires two witnesses. Now, the Mishnah, that's the Tanakhama Shita, and therefore the Tanakhama holds that like any other scenario, a father and son cannot testify together as witnesses. In fact, any two relatives cannot testify as witnesses if they're sufficiently closely related. And the reason why is based on a pasuk. It's not that we think they're going to lie or conspire. It's just that the drush is a drush from a pasuk. The pasuk says, lo yamusu avos al banim uvanim lo yumsu al avos. We won't, children won't be killed through their parents, nor will parents be killed through their children. And the drush there is saying that not only will children or parents not testify against one another, but even won't testify with one another. And that actually applies to all relatives that are sufficiently close, defined elsewhere in Sanhedrin. But the Mishnah here specifically picks a father and son because, as we'll see in a few moments, there actually was a particular episode where a father and son were involved. But this would be true for two brothers, etc. Okay, so the Tanakhama holds that the rules of Eidos testimony apply equally by Kiddush HaChodesh to other scenarios, and therefore a father and son team would be unacceptable based on the drasha on that pasuk. Now, Rabbi Shimon disagrees. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Av Uvano V'kola Krovin K'sherin Le'Eidos HaChodesh. Rabbi Shimon disagrees and says that when it comes to the testimony to confirm that the new moon had been sighted, relatives are permissible. Parent, father and son, or other kind of relations are indeed acceptable. And the reason why Rabbi Shimon holds this is based on the fact, it's also a drasha, but the fact that when the pasuk says, HaChodesh Zelachem, this is how the new moon should look, to decree the new moon, the mitzvah, that mitzvah is given, V'yomar Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron. It's given specifically, not just to Moshe, which is usual, but also to Aaron. And the drasha there is to understand that just as it was given to Moshe and Aaron, who were two brothers, to see the new moon, so we learn from there that you can accept witnesses who are relatives like brothers or father and son for Kiddush HaChodesh in general. That's Rabbi Shimon's Shita. And therefore, Kiddush HaChodesh is just different than other kinds of DNA Torah that require testimony of Edom. The Chacham reject that. They say it's true that it's unusual that Aaron is being mentioned, and there's something to learn from that Pasuk. But what they say it's to teach you is just as Moshe and Aaron were the Gedolei Hador in their time, and they're the ones who are authorized to exclusion of other people to be Mekadosh the Chodesh, so too, in every generation, it's only the Gedolei Hador, meaning the Sanhedrin, or who they designate as such, to serve as the Bezdin. You need to have just three people, but they're from the Sanhedrin, or from the Sanhedrin's appointees, as Gedolei Hador, who are authorized and able to do the sanctification of the new moon. So that's the point of the drush there. Therefore, we're not telling that relatives are permitted to be witnesses together, and therefore, they reject that. Now, Amar Biyosi. Rabbi Yossi said, Masa, it actually happened once, but Tuvia HaRofe, Tuvia the doctor, She'ra'a Esachodesh, he saw the new moon, B'Yerushalayim, who, not only did he see it, Uvano, also his son saw it, Va'avdo HaMeshuchrar, and also his freed slave. A freed slave, an Eved Kanani, who was emancipated, becomes a full-blown Jew, just like a convert, because to become an Eved Kanani in the first place requires not just the acceptance of keeping the Torah's mitzvahs like any Jewish woman, those same requirements, but also there's a bris milah, a circumcision that they undergo, and an immersion in a mikvah. So that's really the requirements of conversion as well. Therefore, it's sort of almost like when they get nishtachrer, they get emancipated, it's like almost like a conversion to the back door, if you will. So an eved meshuchrar, a freed slave, is essentially a Jew across the board, just like a convert. The only question is if they're acceptable as witnesses because they're not from Jewish lineage or not. So there's these three people, the father, the son, and the freed slave. And they all went now to testify regarding the new moon. Now, according to Tanakhama, the father and son would be unacceptable. According to Rabbi Shimon, they would be yes acceptable. Now, when they arrived, Kiblu HaKohanim Osov Esbeno. The Kohanim who were there, it's not perfectly clear who these Kohanim were, if they were authorized or they're sticking the nose where they didn't belong, it's not clear. But anyways, the Kohanim there, they gave their opinion, and they said Tuvia and his son will be acceptable, meaning they are agreeing with Rabbi Shimon's drasha, and they were not going to allow the Eved Meshachrar, the freed slave. However, Ufasalu es Avdo, and they reject the freed slave, Tuvia's slave. However, Ukashabol if they bezin, when they actually came before the Sanhedrin itself, who Paskin according to Lach, how it is, Kiblu Osova es Avdo, they accepted Tuvia and his freed slave, Ufasalu es Beno, and they rejected Tuvia's son. Meaning they Paskin like the Tanakhama, that a father and son cannot testify together, nor can any relatives combine for Edus for Kiddush HaChodesh, but an Eved Meshachrar, an emancipated slave, is now a full-blown Jew in every sense of the word, even to give Edus, to give testimony, while a slave is still a slave before emancipation. As we'll see in the next Mishnah, he is not kosher for Edus, but once he's emancipated, he's a full-blown Jew and can be accepted, along with Tuvia in this case, to give Edus to be Mekadosh the Chodesh. Rosh Hashanah Perek Aleph Mishnah Ches 1:8. Now the Mishnah will digress for a moment to discuss, in general, certain people who are puzzle invalid for giving Edus testimony for rabbinic reasons. Now, to understand this a little better, one has to understand there's a machlokas between Abai and Rav and the Gemara over what constitutes a psul doraisa, who is forbidden to be an aid on a Torah level. Now, the base of this is a pasuk, which is Shmos Perk Chav Gimel Pasuk Aleph, which says, Al tashes yadcha im rasha lios eid chamas. The literal translation of that pasuk is not to extend one's hand with the Russia, the wicked person, to be a Eid Hamas, a corrupt witness. There's a drasha made in this pasuk. According to Abaye, anybody who's a Rasha is going to be pasul, invalid for being an aid on a d'oraisa level. And that means the definition is anybody who violates an isra d'oraisa, a lav, something that's prohibited by the Torah, for which there's consequences, like lashes or worse, and he does it mezid intentionally, so he is called a Rasha, and such a person is pasul for aidus. According to Rava, he understands that the essential word in that pasuk is that the Eid Hamas, the corrupt witness, and Rav understands that to be a invalid aid on a d'oraisa level, one must be guilty of being a gozlan or something similar. He's a thief or robber. He does a specific financial crime. Other kind of crimes, let's say, you know, eating bacon and eggs for breakfast, even b'mezid, wouldn't make a person pasul for edus, according to Rava. Now, the Bar Tanura in our Gemara over here, our Mishnah over here, learns like Rava, that anybody who does an Aveira Midoraisa, unless it's got to do with financial impropriety, is going to be only pasul Midorabanan. The Halacha, however, follows Abaye, that anybody who does any Isra D'oraisa, for which the consequences are lashes or worse, and does it b'mezid, he knows what he's doing and violates it anyways, he'll be pasul on a d'oraisa level. So to explain this mission, I'm going to explain it according to the Bar Tanura, like Rav at first, but I'll have to also, because of halachal mice considerations, also explain how Abaye would learn this Mishnah. So the Mishnah starts out by saying, Elohen apsulin, the following people are pasul, they're invalid to be witnesses on a rabbinic level. The first is hamesachek bekubia, literally, someone who plays with dice. Kubia, of course, analog, cognate of the modern-day word cube, referring to dice, but in time of the Mishnah, they didn't use dice as we know them. They used something called, I think it's pronounced an astrologus, astrologi, which are like kind of almost kind of cubic ankle bones from sheep and so on. I say that because the Bar Tanura specifically says atzamos, their bones, so that's what it's referring to, and that's the origin of the modern-day dice as we have them today, and they play dice, you know, like games of luck. The idea being, this person is a gambler, and a gambler is pasul for edus, at least midrabanan, according to the Bar Tanura, who learns, like the pshat of Ram Bar Chama on the Gemara in Sanhedrin Chav Dalet, he is really a thief on a rabbinic level. Why rabbinic level? Because midoraisa, to be a gazan, to rob somebody, you have to take their money by force, you have to seize their money, and that would make you a thief, midoraisa. In the case of a gambler, according to this pshat, he's actually handing over his money, albeit unwillingly. So when he puts his money down to make a bet, he doesn't intend to lose the money. He intends to get it back. It's called an asmachta. He's just putting the money down, you know, but with the intention of not losing it. So when he actually loses his bet or the wager or the gamble, whatever it is, so then it's taken from him, but he hands it over just unwillingly. It doesn't seize from him. So that's not considered gazela on a d'oraisa level, just a d'rabanan level. That's the Bar Tanura learns, like Ram Bar Chama. There is a second pshat in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is the pshat that's given by Rav Sheshes. Rav Sheshes says the reason why a gambler is pasul midrabanan for edus is because he's not osik b'yishuvo shel olam. He's not involved in the, literally it means like the settlement of the world, but we're talking about he's not involved in the normal society and normal economy around him. And that being the case, he doesn't have interests that are aligned with the rest of the community. Either it means that he simply just doesn't appreciate what it means to have a hard-earned dollar, and that being the case, he doesn't respect people's money, or perhaps just because he doesn't have a stake in society like other people, you know, he doesn't mind if the world collapses and, you know, goes to hell in a handbasket because he makes his living by gambling outside that. So therefore, he has no fear of sin or no stake in concern with society flowing properly. He's an outsider, and that being the case, he can't be trusted to be an aid to ensure that he's not, you know, causing chaos intentionally. Whatever the case is, that's how the Bar Tanura learns that it's a derabanan psul because he's a gambler. Bemalve beribis, the second person is someone who lends money to interest. So someone who lends money to interest, that's already an iser d'oraisa. But according to Rava, like the Bar Tanura learns, that's not being a gazlan, and that not being a thief proper. And that being the case, clearly this is a person who is greedy, and his avarice is likely to corrupt him in the context of whatever he's doing in the court, because he's doing things that are, you know, illegal to make money. But it's the sort of the modern day equivalent of, say, being a drug dealer or something, an arms runner. So this is a shady character, but not a gazlan technically, and therefore not pasul midoraisa, but certainly pasul midorabanan. According to Abaye, who holds that it's written isur doraisa bemazid, doing such a thing would already make you pasul midoraisa. So he's going to have to learn the scenario is somehow that it's only a rabbinic violation. The simplest explanation would be that he's not charging ribis on a doraisa level. He's not like sort of setting a price ahead of time that he's going to charge in terms of interest, but rather he collects some sort of indirect payment, which constitutes ribis derabanan. Like, for example, Mr. A lends Mr. B money, and then Mr. A stays in Mr. B's house and doesn't pay him rent. So he's not actually taking money, but he's getting a benefit. That's considered to be ribis midorabanan. So such a person would only be possible midorabanan, according to Abaye. Umefriche yonim. These are dove chasers, dove flyers. So according to the Bar Tanura, the pshat here is very similar to the Masachah B'Kuvia. These are gamblers, kind of like horse racing. They were pigeon racing. And again, they're gamblers, and therefore they're possible for the reasons we said before. There's another pshat in what mafrichi yonim are, which would make it not sort of a redundant case in the Mishnah, and that is someone, this is the pshat also in Sanhedrin, someone who goes sort of stealing his neighbor's pigeons from their dovecotes. Remember, we learned from Sechas Beitza not long ago, if you set up a dovecote in your backyard, essentially a glorified, you know, birdhouse, but like a bird hotel, so the birds will live in your backyard. You never actually made a kinyan to pick them up to acquire them. It's not technically not yours. And if someone would chase them away to their backyard, they didn't do anything directly with their hands to take anything that was specifically yours. So really, it's not on Dorais level stealing. It's just Durabanan stealing. So that's the second shot that's given on what Mafriche Yona pigeon chases are in Sanhedrin Daf Chafei. Okay. Furthermore, Vesochre Shvias, people who do commerce with Shemitah produce, which is an Isur D'Oraisa. One can't do commercial activities with seventh-year produce in Eretz Yisrael. And one who does is considered to be possible for Eidus, according to the Bar Tanura, because this is not a considered to be a gazlan, but he certainly is, again, greedy and corruptible and doing things that are, you know, improper for the sake of making a profit. And that being the case, we don't trust him in the courts to give testimony, because who knows what he's going to do. But according to Abaye, you'd have to say this is somehow a derabanan crime, because again, a deraisa makes him pasul midoraisa. If the isser were an isser deraisa, then that would make him pasul midoraisa. So, for example, different pshatim given, perhaps already the halach of shvias of shmita produce in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Mishnah is only derabanan according to some. According to others, it could be that he didn't do it but maze it, he didn't know what he was doing was forbidden, and which would make him not pasul midoraisa, and so on. And finally, va'avadim. This is an Eved Kanani, a non-Jewish slave. We had mentioned in the previous Mishnah, we were talking about the freed slave. Now, an Eved Kanani is pasul for giving edus on a d'oraisa level. So he doesn't really belong on this list, but he's included on this list to make sure things are clear and really to contrast with what we said before. So an Eved who's learned as a kol v'chomer, all the more so if a woman isn't kosher as a witness, and she is certainly kosher as a Jew in every way, and welcome to, you know, an intermarriage she likes and so on. An Eved, who is not yet a Jew, he's like whatever he is, he's a quasi-Jew, it's hard to explain exactly, he's chayv mitzvahs like a woman, but certainly not a woman proper, and not Jew proper, who can't marry into the Jewish community freely, so he's for sure all the more so invalid on a d'oraisa level to be an aid. Zehaklal, the principle is, the governing principle is, Kol edus she'ein ha'isha k'sher la, avhein einen k'sherim la. Any scenario where a woman can't serve as an aid, these people are pasul midorabanan, or in the case of the Eved Kanani, even pasul midoraisa for normal testimony, can give testimony where a woman as a single witness could give testimony. So that means in most scenarios, these people are of course pasul, but there are certain scenarios, like for example, in the case of a sota, a woman who already had Kinu and Stira, she was already put on notice by her husband not to hang out with a certain man who she suspected to being doing something infidelitous with, and later on she's discovered to be with him. So we would accept even the testimony of one woman in such a scenario regarding the sota, because there already is reglam l'davar. There's already a strong presumption in the matter to not allow her to drink from the mesota, the sota water. And similarly, in the case of stopping a gunos, if a woman lost her husband, and the only people who know what happened to the husband, that he died, is someone who's pasul mudarban, or a woman, or an eved, so those people could give testimony to confirm the death of her husband to enable her, this widow, to remarry as a widow.